Johann Sebastian Bach acquired the Caliph Bible in 1733. At least that is what I take that date to mean, which is written below his signature on the title page of each of the three volumes. I do not subscribe to the theory of Gerhard Hertz that Bach may have inscribed his name and the date several years after he acquired the work. If that were the case, the date wouldn't mean anything. Moreover, there is not one shred of evidence to support it. Bach died in 1750. This means that whatever he penned in this Bible occurred between 1733 and 1750. In the division of his estate among his wife and nine surviving children, the Caliph Bible went to Anna Magdalena. From here, there is a gap of nearly 100 years in our knowledge of its whereabouts, and what we know about it subsequently comes by working from the other end. The full story of the rediscovery of Bach's Bible is ably presented in Robin Lever's beautifully illustrated new book, J.S. Bach and Scripture. I'm glad to see Robin Lever here this morning. At least he has utilized all of the available evidence. I will simply give a brief report leading up to my own research. In 1934, this Bible surfaced in the home of a Michigan farmer, Leonard Reichle. It was during a synod of the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church meeting at Frankenmuth. One delegate who stayed with Reichle was his cousin, Pastor Christian Riedel. At one point, Reichle showed Riedel a Bible which he said his father had purchased in Philadelphia between 1836 and 1847. It was volume 3 of the Caliph Bible, and Riedel observed Bach's signature and date, which apparently the Reichle family had not noticed. Subsequently, it was recognized as authentic by the noted Bach scholar Hans Preuss in Erlangen. A few months later, the first two volumes were found stashed away in the attic, each of which was found to have the same signature and date on the title page. Reichle was under some pressure to give the volumes to the Bach House in Eisenach, but given the climate in Germany, he refused, and in 1938, he gave them to Concordia Seminary. For the next 30 years or so, the Caliph Bible remained unattended. Oral tradition says that it got lost in the library. But in 1968, it surfaced again when Christoph Trautmann searched it out and persuaded Concordia Seminary to lend it for a display at a Bach Fest in Germany. A member of the executive committee of the Neue Bach Gesellschaft, he kept and studied it for a year before returning it. In 1969, he published an article which first brought it to the attention of the scholarly world. That article was translated and published in the Concordia Theological Monthly in February 1971. Trautmann's article had both positive and negative consequences. To tell the story of this Bible and to give a general description of its contents was a very important contribution. But without a scholarly examination of the script, he raised serious doubts about the authenticity of most of the hand-penned material. He accepted the four comments relating music to worship and all the entries made with red ink, but this left the bulk of the writing and marking open to question. What made this especially difficult is the high proportion of underlining and or marginal marks to script. He suggested that the identity of the writers could never be known. Bach's Bible was now in a state of limbo, with only a few passages reliably assigned to Bach. This was the state of affairs at the time that I became involved. It was Alfred Mann, professor of musicology at the Eastman School of Music, who asked me if I would make a study of Bach's Bible on behalf of the American chapter of the New Bach Society. And this was in 1975, and the American chapter was newly formed, and he was secretary. He was also the director of the Bethlehem Bach Choir, of which I am a member. On behalf of the American chapter, he procured a microfilm copy of the Bible for my use, and he gave me a copy of Trautmann's article. Rarely has a research project had such a modicum of source material. The first look at the Bible left me very bewildered. Like many others, I assumed that one would find comments that would tell us what Bach was thinking about in the selection of his texts. I remember Larry Bielenberg, the former librarian here, telling me early on that from time to time, local musicians would come here to the library asking to see the Bach Bible in the hope that they might find a statement that would relate to one of Bach's musical compositions. But there is only one comment which mentions a specific musical composition, and that we cannot identify, certainly not to my satisfaction. This is found in the margin of Exodus 15:20, Miriam's song. In translation, it reads, NB. There are about 30 NBs written in the margins of the Caliph Bible. NB, first prelude for two choirs to be performed to the honor of God. Some scholars associate this comment with motet number one, Singet den Herrn ein neues Lied. And there are striking resemblances. The first chorus of Singet den Herrn is written for double choir. Miriam's song in the text of the Bible begins with the words Singet den Herrn. And the round dance figure in the chorus of that double chorus reflects the German word Reigen in the text. But the problem with this is that the new chronology designates 1727 as the date of the composition of Singet den Herrn. This was 6 years before Bach acquired the Bible. It is the attempt to get around this problem that has given rise to Gerhard Hertz's theory about Bach's penning the date 1733 in his name at a later time, having owned the Bible in 1727, you see, when Singet den Herrn was written. The three other comments on music, which are represented here in these beautiful photographs, are general in character, linking music to worship. There is also one geographical comment where Bach mentions a town named Schwerborn as being close to Erfurt. Apart from these references, all other notations relate specifically to the text, showing that the interest of the writer was in the biblical text itself or in the theological commentary accompanying it. So, following good exegetical method, it was important to approach this study with the attitude of finding what is there instead of looking for something that might be there. I well remember a quotation of John Calvin. Maybe John Calvin isn't quoted in this seminary, but it's a good statement on exegesis. He said, it's the first business of an interpreter to let his author say what he does say instead of attributing to him what we think he ought to say. It's a marvelous statement on what exegesis ought to be. So we look for what's there instead of trying to assume what we'd like to find there. I decided that I would not pick up where Trautmann left off, but would start a fresh study of the text and use Trautmann only for reference. So I began to compile a list of pages where entries were to be found, to note types of entries, and even to assess their intrinsic value. It was my intention from the beginning to publish the Bach entries once they were authenticated. That is, publish those that were authenticated, whatever they were, whichever ones they were. I divided this list into two categories, which I labeled source material for reproduction and source material for notation. The latter is now found in the appendix to chapter 2 of the volume which has been published. It consists of spelling corrections, repeated words crossed out, and other changes of form. Over a period of 3 or 4 years, I went through the microfilm copy several times. I had to examine each page meticulously because some of the entries are quite obscure, at least on the microfilm. In fact, every time I went through it, I found a few entries I had not seen before. I was convinced that the question of authentication had to be met head on. And given the character of the source material, it appeared to me almost from the start that an ink analysis that would relate the underlining and marginal marks to the script was the only way of finding a solution to the problem. I did not know if this had ever been done, but I assumed that it could be done. I think I had absorbed the common idealistic attitude towards scientific achievement, which belonged to the social climate. Science can solve any technical problem. But I was to discover that ink analysis of historic documents had not been done before. I began a search for a laboratory that could do ink analysis, and my first contact was the Winterthur Museum in Delaware. My son, who was a museum curator, was a fellow at Winterthur at that time, and I had learned from him that the major museums had developed laboratories where very sophisticated methods are used in the examination of artifacts. Winterthur has such a laboratory, and the specialist with whom I spoke has done research on paper, but they had not analyzed ink. He suggested a private investigator in the Washington, D.C. area who had done work for the FBI. This was the beginning of a long chain of contacts over a period of about 3 years, which seemed fruitless, but which in the end paid off. The other institutions contacted are the following: the Smithsonian Institution, Conservation Analytical Laboratory, the U.S. Department of Commerce, Bureau of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco. That's the most important one. National Archives, as I'll tell you shortly. National Archives, Document Preservation Branch, Library of Congress, Preservation Office, Metropolitan Museum of Art, Brookhaven Laboratories, Walter C. McCrone Associates, Lehigh University, Department of Materials Research, and Washington University, the Center for Archaeometry. Two of these famous institutions responded positively at first, but later discovered that they were not really equipped to do the testing. In one case, I later realized that I had intruded on a political power struggle where the scientist with whom I was dealing was being pushed out. He wanted me to contact him at his home rather than at his office, which I thought strange. However, I continued to contact his office, and I was soon informed that he had been replaced. There's one government agency which has a specialist on ink analysis, and that is the Bureau of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco. And he told me that he could do the research which I needed, and I believed him. But, he said, he was restricted by law to forensic research. And that seemed to close the door on that possibility. One laboratory which showed a keen interest in the project was the Center for Archaeometry here at Washington University. Larry Bielenberg had told me that he would scout this area for institutions that could do ink analysis, and he brought this to my attention. We began discussions, and a team from the center made a preliminary examination of the Caliph Bible, comparing a number of entries using optical microscopy. Then on one of my trips here, I conferred with two of the scientists at the center. Their plan was to remove minute samples from the entries, so small as to escape notice, and test them analytically. They proposed a series of 40 samples, which seemed too small to me on a strictly commercial basis, which seemed too costly to me. So I continued to look elsewhere. It was about this time that I began to have discussions with Macrone Laboratories in Chicago. They also function on a strictly commercial basis. As perhaps the most prestigious laboratory for analytical work known at the present time, they examined the Shroud of Turin and the equally controversial Yale-Vinland map. They have a range of techniques for non-destructive analysis. They suggested experimenting with these techniques in order to find the most adaptable and useful one. I was also given the name of an ink specialist at the Parker Penn Laboratories. I might well have pursued these two avenues further, but one day I received a call from Professor Robert Anderson of San Jose State University in California. He told me that someone at the Smithsonian Institution had informed him of my search for a laboratory to do the ink analysis. He went on to say that the University of California had developed such a process and was testing old manuscripts. But he wanted to know more about Bach's Caliph Bible before putting me in touch with the laboratory. I was well prepared for this situation. I knew all along that if a laboratory did emerge that could test the inks, there needed to be a method by which the results could be utilized. So I had worked out a procedure that would relate the entries of known authorship with the entries of unknown authorship. I had made a list of assumptions, and I had prepared lists of entries to be tested according to categories. I labeled this prepared document Methodology for Authenticating the Hand-Penned Material in Bach's Caliph Bible. Indeed, on a trip here, I showed it to Larry Bielenberg because I wanted him to know how important ink analysis was in solving the problem of authentication. And I wanted him to see how it could be used. He asked for a copy for the library file, which I gave him, with the understanding that no one else could use it for research purposes, and I presume it's still in your file. It was this paper on methodology which I sent to Professor Anderson. He, in turn, sent it to Richard Schwab, Professor of History at the University of California, Davis. Professor Schwab is a member of the team which developed the process of testing the inks of historic manuscripts there. On the basis of this paper, Professor Schwab called me and expressed interest in having the Crocker Nuclear Laboratory do the ink analysis. He said that they were interested in this project for the sake of their own research, and that costs for the use of the cyclotron, which would be involved, could be a shared expense. The analytical method, he said, was fully non-destructive, and the security provisions were excellent. After a long and drawn-out search, I felt I had finally found what I was looking for, and I believed that Concordia would find it acceptable. Given the heavy demands on the cyclotron for many purposes, the first date on which it was available for our use was July 22, 1982. Concordia Seminary, while reluctant to allow Bach's Bible to pass out of their domain, nevertheless exercised their better judgment and planned the transportation accordingly. With heavy insurance coverage, it was planned that I should take Volume 1 with me en route. The volume was packed and padded in an ordinary hardcover suitcase. This is the most valuable of the three because it has more hand-penned material than the other two combined. The other two volumes were sent by air freight in a heavy aluminum case. Needless to say, they all arrived safely on schedule and were whisked away to the fastness of the Special Collections Department of the University of California Library. Psychologically, I felt ambivalent about transporting Volume 1. On the one hand, the feeling of responsibility for what is to me one of the most valuable documents in the whole world can be frightening. On the other hand, when I viewed that ordinary-looking suitcase, I thought that one needs only to act in an ordinary way. If I arrived safely, so would the book. Bruce Cusco, whom I will later identify as the physicist who has worked with me, who wrote the chapter on the ink analysis in the book, Bruce Cusco met me at the airport. An advanced graduate student at that time, he was a member of the team which had developed the method of ink analysis using the cyclotron, and he was writing his doctoral dissertation on the method itself. He expressed a particular interest in the Bach Bible. And when I saw over the next few days how intimately familiar he was with that enormously complex system of equipment, I decided that he was the one whose assistance I would seek in interpreting the results of the ink analysis. Bruce and I kept in regular contact from then on, working together with the computer printouts until the solution to the problem was forthcoming. At 10:30 on the morning of July 22nd, we began testing the samples from Volume 1. I was told that it took about 2 hours for technicians to start the cyclotron and bring it to operating condition. The book itself was placed upon a specially designed lectern that swivels so that a single page can be positioned to line up a given spot with the proton beam. This proton beam shoots through about a square centimeter or less of the page with its ink, isolating the constituent elements and indicating their comparative quantities. This information is fed to a massive computer, which prints it out almost immediately. Thomas Cahill, the director of the Crocker Nuclear Laboratory, was manning the testing site, and I was assisting him. Bruce Cusco was operating the computer with the help of one or two assistants. We kept going until 10:30 that night without a scheduled break. 6 hours of that time were devoted to the Bach Bible. There were two other items, the testing of which had to be included, and there were two breakdowns. At the end, we had tested 102 samples, all from Volume 1. I'd say at 10:30, the three of us went out for dinner. Having used the time allotted to us for the cyclotron, some accommodations had to be made for testing the other two volumes. The next opportunity for continuing the ink analysis of the Bach Bible, I was told, would be early September. That posed difficulties. I could hardly make the transcontinental flight again, nor could I expect Concordia Seminary to release the Bible again. I phoned Concordia to ask if they would allow the two other volumes to remain until September. Larry Bielenberg was away. But the very capable Mrs. Murley was able to contact him, and together they agreed to allow the extension. As it happened, the testing did not take place until October 13th because of a lengthy computer breakdown. 51 samples from those two volumes were tested, bringing the total to 153. Subsequently, one had to be eliminated. Thomas Cahill told me that the Bach Bible was allowed more testing time than any other single item which had come under the cyclotron's proton beam up to that time. I returned Volume 1 to its home in the Concordia Library on my return flight. Mark Wengren met me at the airport. When we arrived here, Larry Bielenberg was waiting, almost pacing the floor. No sooner did we unpack the volume than Larry began leafing through it, looking at one entry after another in rapid progression. I realized that he was checking for any damage that may have been done, but of course, he found none. Then I showed him the computer printouts, and he was as bewildered as I. We knew we had data, but we also knew that we had no capacity to evaluate them. I realized then that there was a long way to go before any judgment about the authenticity of the entries could be made, and my dependence upon Bruce Cusco became all the more apparent. The printouts of the samples tested from volumes 2 and 3 arrived late in 1982 or early in 1983. I think it was at the very end of December of 82, but I'm not sure. But in addition, Bruce included three complete sets of printouts which were normalized to three of the most persistent and important elements in the inks, iron, copper, and zinc. It was this kind of complex a situation to try to explain what this means, to normalize the data to one of these. Well, let me try. What was done to normalize all this data to iron, for example, was to give the figure 100 to the iron content of every entry, and then give the proportionate quantity of the other elements in each case. So this, of course, didn't give exact absolute quantities. It gave proportionate quantities. But these additional sets made it possible to place the entries on graphs. And when that was done, the entries could be seen to form clusters. Now I began to see how the data could be used to establish a process for authentication. We concentrated on the entries made with black ink because these constituted the vast majority. At first, there appeared to be two main clusters, one with about 20 items and the other with about 50 items. The smaller one included all of those examples of handwriting which were recognized as box handwriting, namely the signatures, the dates, and the four comments on music. Thus, we felt confident about the authenticity of the other entries within that cluster. But we had no norm by which to assess the entries in the larger cluster. gradually it became obvious to me that handwriting analysis was equally important to ink analysis in the authentication process. By the fall of 1983, I knew that a major effort in the study of box handwriting had to be undertaken. I had a few facsimiles of Bach manuscripts, which I had acquired in Leipzig in 1978. These I began to study for style. I also visited the Princeton University Library a few times to look at their collection of facsimiles. Paula Morgan, the music librarian there, showed me Arthur Mendel's extensive card file on Bach's handwriting, which the library had received after his death. One can see from this card file alone the enormous variety in Bach's handwriting. But it can also be somewhat misleading, because one may be led to believe that changes in style relate to the different time periods in Bach's life. There are subtle changes over the years which experts can discern, but more striking is the considerable variety of style within given manuscripts. In other words, Bach wrote with a great deal of variety all the time. For example, Bach wrote NB, I told you there are about 30 of them in the margins of the Caliph Bible, in two distinctly different ways. So different that one would suspect different writers, as Trautmann did. But there are so many examples of both types in authenticated Bach manuscripts that the evidence is clear that he wrote them both. Indeed, I found both types in a single manuscript. So I did not really use Mendel's file as a reference. Rather, I wrote to the Bach Archiv in Leipzig and asked them to send me a small collection of facsimiles, which they did. Since I had become rather familiar with the handwriting of the entries in the Caliph Bible, I was always looking for parallel forms in other authenticated manuscripts, and I became more and more convinced of the witness to Bach's hand throughout. Since the literary analysis is the key to utilizing the ink analysis, it seemed important to make the strongest possible case. The practiced eye of a seasoned scholar would carry a great deal of weight with the community of Bach scholars. I could think of no one whose judgments are more highly respected than those of Hans Joachim Schulze, the archivist in Leipzig. What remained to be done was to evaluate on literary grounds all of the examples of handwriting that had been subject to ink analysis. I contacted Concordia Library and asked to have photos taken of these entries. Mrs. Murley was expeditious in having this done. Of the 152 entries which had been analyzed physically, 64 were subject to handwriting analysis. In March 1984, I took these photos to Leipzig with me and showed them to Hans Joachim Schulze. He divided them into three categories. One, definitely Bach. There were more than half, I think 34. Two, probably Bach. I think there were 10 of those. And three, possibly Bach, and I think there were 11 of those. I was also able to look at a number of important Bach manuscripts there, which had not been available to me heretofore and which proved very important and valuable for data. When I returned home, I gave these new data to Bruce Cusco, and from here on, everything began to fall into place. While I had been working on the literary analysis, Bruce had been refining the technique for evaluating the physical data. He had now isolated 9 ink groups. All 3 of Schulze's categories were brought together in these groups, as you can see in the graphs in the volume. The inks of the underlining and marginal marks were found to be common to the inks of the authenticated handwriting. We can say that there is a strong probability that all of the penned material comes from the hand of J.S. Bach. At least the burden of proof is on anyone who doubts the authenticity of any entry. The problem of authentication, which came into being with the initial research on the Bach Bible, has led to a new method of research for manuscripts in general. To the best of my knowledge, my project has utilized the analysis of manuscript ink for the first time. For the future, this method may be useful not only for other problems of authenticity, but also for problems of chronology. Borrowing a tool from archaeology, I can imagine the development of an ink chronology index. But for the present, we can feel justified in claiming the penned material in Bach's Caliph Bible as Bach source material.